From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Games bring out the competitor in all of us.
Look, he's in the water! All right, I'm gonna catch him. All right, get him. Here we go. Come on. All first, go!
Today, The Break Room dives into Pokemon Go and how catching little monsters in the virtual world comes with real-world dangers. We'll also hear from the Georgia Track Club. The club will send a number of athletes to the Summer Olympic Games in Rio next month. But the road to the Olympics can be expensive. We'll talk about the financial challenges that athletes face. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, it is tomato season. We talked about gardening tips and the best way to eat tomatoes yesterday. Chef Drew Boleen shared this delicious recipe.
To get your cherry tomatoes, the Sun Golds are my favorite. Toss them in a bowl with some really good olive oil, some really good sea salt, a really nice twist of fresh cracked pepper. We got to my herb garden. I pick some thyme. I pick some basil. I kind of just the whole stem, everything. Just throw it on in there. Smash a couple cloves of garlic. Toss all of that together. I'm going to put it on a little baking sheet per tray, and I'm going to throw it in the oven at 300 degrees, and I'm going to slow roast these tomatoes for an hour and a half. And they're just going to kind of wilt down and get a little bit caramely on top, but they're not cooked all the way. And what these tomatoes are doing when they're really juicy and at the peak of the season is they're releasing all of that moisture into the olive oil.
And we wanted to know about your favorite tomato recipe, so here are your first thoughts. Sam Miller shared his delicious tomato pudding recipe. He writes, "During the summer when fresh tomatoes are available, I use them to make my puree in the food processor." We posted his pudding recipe to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio just in case you want to take it on with some of your own garden-grown tomatoes. We also heard from Jay Eldred on Twitter. He says he prefers his tomatoes thin sliced on white bread with salt, pepper, and Duke's mayo. And Donna Butler reached us on Facebook to offer this tip. She says, "It's great you have tomatoes to share, but please don't waste any. Tomatoes are easy to freeze and can." We also talked about former Atlanta Falcon Michael Vick yesterday. He's the subject of a new documentary series by The Bleacher Report. It explores how the dogfighting scandal that sent Vick to prison changed him. And we wondered if you still think of Vick first as an athlete or as an animal abuser. Mike Tanner tweets, "I think about how one was wasted by the other, but I also consider his life since." And Clientele 6 tweets, "I have always supported Michael Vick. Even after the animal abuse scandal, I have done what no one else has done. Forgive him." We always love to get your thoughts, so call us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The Summer Olympic Games in Rio will begin in just a few weeks. Athletes from across the world will be there to compete, and among them, members of the Georgia Track Club. The Georgia Track Club won 7 medals at the last Olympics in London, and the team hopes to score big in the upcoming games. I spoke with 2 members of the club back in February. Angelo Taylor is one of Atlanta's Olympic hopefuls. He's a 3-time Olympic gold medalist and 4-time Olympic competitor. Hazel Clark also joined us. She's a 3-time Olympian and the executive director of the Georgia Track Club. And I started the conversation by asking Hazel about the history of Georgia's prestigious track club.
Well, I'll tell you the history, the legacy of Olympians in Georgia is unprecedented. I think it's by far one of the strongest in the whole nation. There's just something about Georgia Olympians, Georgia athletes. They've won, as you said, so many medals. And when it's time to, you know, represent the world and represent their state, they do it in fine fashion. And I think they're more than great athletes. They're great role models. I mean, there's just so many names, so many legends. And so we're celebrating that and really excited about this next Olympics.
And let me brag for you just a little bit. The Georgia Track Club has brought home 13 Olympic medals. 8 of them were golds. The club has 14 World Outdoor Championship medals and 13 World Indoor Championship medals. You know, I mentioned your training earlier, Angelo, but training for the Olympics is a full-time job, is it not?
Most definitely. It's a full-time job. Most mornings I wake up at 6 a.m. and sometimes I don't get home until 8 a.m. at night. So it's a tough, rigorous schedule. Every year we're training. You know, most people think that we only train during the Olympic Games, you know, every 4 years. But every year there's a season, mostly overseas, and we're training to, you know, stay tip-top shape so we can compete at our optimum level.
And I mention this, Hazel, because one of the things that the Georgia Track Club does is tries to support athletes like Angelo, who clearly can't stop training and go to a job. right? How do you do that?
Absolutely. You know, it's just so important that we, first of all, educate the community. When I first started asking community members for support, they said, well, these are Olympic gold medalists. Aren't they millionaires?
And we mean financial support is
yes,
what we're talking
financial,
about. Money.
Financial support, resources, yes. And they were shocked to find that so many of these athletes that represent, you know, our world in such a fine fashion don't have, live below the poverty level or don't have sponsorships or don't have the support that they need to really sustain. A lot of them are forced sometimes to try to take a part-time job, which is not conducive to being able to compete at a high level. And it's a difficult thing, but with community support, with local sponsors, we've been able to really put together some resources for our team members, and we look forward to continuing to do it so that they have the opportunity to shine without stress.
You know, Angela, one of the things that I think most people know is that the Olympics have changed their rules on amateurs to a certain extent. You can get endorsements if you want, but I can't imagine that's easy unless you're somebody like Usain Bolt, right? Have you been able to get in the kind of endorsements you would need to support your athletic endeavors?
That's correct. We as a USA Track and Field, as a national governing body, we take about 125 athletes to the Olympic Games. So when people think about endorsements, think Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps, you know, maybe Gabby Douglas. That's three people, but we have just 125 people on our USA track team. That's not including all the other athletes on our USA team. So it's difficult. I mean, it's tough to, you know, continue your dream and compete every day and sacrifice so much to go out here and train and you bring back medals and all you get is a pat on the back when you get back.
And yet it somehow seems worth it to you. Why is that?
I mean, you're making history, you know. Olympics is one of the oldest, you know, sports in the world. And, you know, to me, you know, I feel like when you go out there and train, you sacrifice, you can be a role model in the community and, you know, inspire young kids to do great things. So,
you're a proud alumnus of the of Georgia Tech, correct?
Correct.
And what are your events, Angelo?
400-meter hurdles and the 4x4 relay.
Hazel, what does it take to actually financially support somebody like Angelo so they can put in the kind of training they need?
For Angelo, you know, you think about travel costs, medical expenses.
I want to be clear here. The U.S. Olympic Committee does not pay for his travel?
Some travel, some minimal travel, to be honest. There's quite a few track meets you have to go to get to the point
to qualify.
Where you can qualify. So he's got to fund that himself if he doesn't have a sponsor. So, you know, we have travel costs. We have medical costs, injuries. You have to go to a chiropractor. You have to go to a doctor. There's no insurance provided to our Olympians and Olympic gold medalists. So there are quite a few expenses. But I would say typically between $50,000 and $70,000 can really make a serious difference in an athlete's life for a year, for an Olympic year, funding year. That's the range that we've seen that has made the difference. So.
How different is it for U.S. Olympic athletes as opposed to Olympic athletes in other countries?
A totally different world. An Olympic gold medalist in another country may come back to a home that's paid for, may come back to a job. Our athletes, you have to also remember, they have sacrificed throughout their career and they have no job experience. So not only did you sacrifice and not make money, you left the sport at 30-something years old and have nothing on your resume, and now you're not hireable. So that's a whole nother issue that is very disturbing and distressing to our athletes. So they do not have the same issues in other countries. You know, they're set up to succeed not only while they're competing, but after these competing is done. And we want to also have those type of resources in place so our athletes can do the same.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Hazel Clark of the Georgia Track Club, herself a three-time Olympian, and Angelo Taylor, who's a three-time Olympic gold medalist and is training for the Olympics this summer. Angelo, you are a 30-something athlete. Have you considered what you might do when you're done with professional sports? Or competitive
yes.
sports, I should say?
Yes, it's crossed my mind a number of times. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to immediately go into coaching and training athletes as well as representing athletes.
So you'll stay in the sport and hopefully it won't be as difficult for you as it is for other Olympians.
That's my plan. So hopefully it won't be as difficult. But like Hazel said, it's definitely tough for most athletes. You've been competing on the international scene for a number of years, and you don't have any job experience. It's been tough I know it's been tough for me. As an older athlete with no sponsorship, looking for work, you go on interviews, you really don't have any work experience, and, you know, it's really tough to even try to get a job. So,
Hazel, is this something that athletes talk about among them? I mean, is it a
It causes me to feel a little bit choked up. I am an Olympian. I come from a family of Olympians, and I've seen this affect so many people that I care about that have sacrificed so much and worked so hard. It's not talked about, and it's my personal passion in my life through the Georgia Track Club and through my other endeavors to make sure that people understand that these athletes need support. This is so important. It's not talked about that our athletes are becoming depressed or, you know, going through this difficult transition. It doesn't have to be. There are people out here that love the Olympics and love our athletes and want and are in a position to hire, are in a position to support, are in a position to give a donation, whether it's $500, $1,000, and every bit counts to allow our athletes not to have to deal with this.
How many athletes do you have at your club that are training and that are hoping to get into the Olympics?
We have 11 athletes right now.
11?
11.
That's a lot of travel.
That's a lot of travel. That's
and
a lot of
insurance.
Medical. Yes, and it's a lot of hard work. And we are passionate about our athletes. They are not just great athletes, but really have done great things in the community and spent a lot of time donating their time to our young people and to our community members.
Angela, I'm looking at your personal record for hurdles at 47.25 seconds. Any chance you might get in the Olympics and break that record this summer?
Hopefully. You know, that's the plan. You know, I think I still got a shot at the world record, so I'm training very hard, and, you know, hopefully I can pull it off this year.
How fast would you have to run the hurdles in order to make that?
The current record is 46.78.
Whew.
And just to tell you about Georgia, Kevin Young holds that record, right, Angela? And he's here in Atlanta, Georgia as well. So
definitely.
The legacy is amazing.
Okay, so Hazel, when does all this begin? When does the tryouts and all that, when does the sort of train start rolling?
The train is rolling now. We had a big launch event where, you know, the city of Atlanta and a lot of government officials came out to support our athletes. They are training now. They are competing now. They're trying to get their marks so that they can qualify for the Olympic trials. And then the day of the Olympic trials is a day that you make it. People don't know that. If you're having a bad day, it doesn't matter how well you competed all year, you will not be on that team. It's probably the most intense pressure situation that anyone can imagine going through.
That was my conversation with Hazel Clark, the executive director of the Georgia Track Club, and three-time Olympian Angela Taylor. I spoke with them back in February. It's been 20 years since Atlanta hosted the Summer Olympics. We'll dedicate a full hour next Tuesday to the legacy of those games and how they transformed the city. We would love to hear from you. Did you go watch any of the events in 1996? What are some of your Olympic memories? Tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. This is On Second Thought. Earlier this week, an anti-Muslim activist named James Tachowiak uploaded a video of himself armed outside the Islamic Community Center of Augusta. We'll play you a short excerpt now, but just a warning to listeners, the language here is offensive.
Islam is not a religion. I'll debate anyone, anywhere, anytime on that. Why? Because any book of any religion, in this case, the toilet paper writings from hell, known as the unholy Quran, the satanic verses, that calls for the death of those that don't submit to it or those that leave it, is not a religion, but it is hate.
Stachowiak goes on to say this later in the video.
Yes, I carry a gun because I will kill anyone, foreign and domestic, that tries to physically attack me for exercising my first right, they'll get a swift lesson in the Second Amendment. Yes, I'm talking hate. Here we go. We got a Muslim driving by right now. Look at this. Just drove in.
He also mentions Muhammad Jamal Dawoodi by name. He's Imam of the Islamic Society of Augusta. I spoke with the Imam back in March about the work he does to combat hate and increase understanding of Islam in his community.
The sense of generalization that all Muslims are terrorists and connecting, you know, some kind of pictures or video clips that they see on the TV with a ritual that is very holy and important for the Muslims, whether they are calling for the prayer or praying or performing whatever rituals. That is really hurting for the larger Muslim population.
So do you think that a leader of a congregation, like an imam or rabbi or pastor, also has that kind of relationship where they might be able to see radicalization beginning to happen?
Well, I myself and the majority of the imams that are, you know, Islamic centers, that we are working closely with the law enforcement agencies in order to detect and, yes, report any kind of suspicious activity. But in this discussion, in this argument, we need really to bring up a kind of a public discussion between legislators who are planning or working on creating those guidelines, and the trainers and the Muslim community, or experts from the Muslim community. These trainers supposed to be either from the Muslim community or working closely with the expert from the Muslim community in order to help them. Because we need to be very careful about these guidelines or these detection, not to fall in the area where we ban or hurt the freedom of speech or freedom of practice in that situation. We need to be very careful in this, because I disagree with the, generalizing and painting these kind of radical behavior with Islam or Christianity or Judaism or any other faith. These are kind of behavior, and Islam is just like any other faith. It is what you bring into. If you have a violent character before you are a Muslim, you will continue to be like this. So yes, there should be a kind of close cooperation between the law enforcement agencies, between the legislators, between the leaders of the Muslim community nationwide, in order to come up with the right policy for that.
We asked Putnam County Sheriff Howard Sills about whether or not he thinks he should incorporate sensitivity training along with training on recognizing radicals. Here's what he had to say.
Obviously, you don't want to offend someone, but you can observe somebody praying without offending them. I don't see how the simple gathering of intelligence as it relates to potential criminal activity could reach a point where you would do something that was insensitive.
What's your response to that?
Yes, that kind of activity will hurt the Muslims. Again, because we are linking a kind of negative evil action to a peaceful, beautiful, law-abiding citizens and followers of certain faith. Sensitivity training, it is important. It is important to run it. And if we did not do it, we are a little bit late. I have been part of many of those programs provided by a wonderful Muslim organization nationwide. Lots of changes, really, and good fruit will come out from that kind of sensitivity training. Because the bottom line, we want to get to the result, to the fruit, to the end of that one. And we have to use all the tools that we can do in order to achieve that properly. And in order not to mess up with the right of practice and the right freedom of speech and others as a normal law-abiding law citizen.
Is it the responsibility, though, of an imam like yourself or a pastor or a priest to identify people who have been radicalized?
It is the responsibility of everybody. Everybody in his own office, in his own job, in his own mission had that responsibility, to report and identify that. Yes, if I would see any kind of suspicious activity, we have zero tolerance for that in our center. So it's not only those radicals, you know, as long as they are connected to a community, so the community itself will be able to identify them and report them and help out with this problem. But if we are trying to put a certain limit and a certain policy, certain principle, they might be working underground, and that it will be harder on the Muslim community and even on the law enforcement agencies to detect them. So we need to we need to be very careful not to hurt the innocent one. At the same time, be smart and you know, wise enough to tackle this issue from different sides.
Muhammad Jamal Daoudi is the Imam of the Islamic Society of Augusta. It has been a long week, and in many ways a tragic one. Here on this show, we've talked about racial battle fatigue, authenticity in music, and the saga of former Falcon Michael Vick. Now, you know what? Let's sit back, relax, clear our minds, and celebrate Friday. Let's head into the break room.
Dude, there's Pokemon in here! David! What are you doing?
Catching Pokemon, dude.
Hey, are you playing Pokemon Go?
Yeah.
We're down.
It feels like you blink and you miss this marriage. Kim and Chris headed for divorce just 72 days after tying the knot.
I like the rhythm. I like the arrangement. I love it. I don't understand Becky with the good hair, though.
Joining us in the break room, Stefan Turkheimer. He's a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Welcome, Stefan.
Hello, Celeste.
Hector Fernandez teaches world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. Always good to see you, Hector.
Morning.
Kalina Bowler is co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. Welcome back, Kalina.
Yes, hello. Thank you.
Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia and yet never brings biscuits.
That is a travesty.
I might have to fix that.
Yeah, I mean, your blog is called if you have all the biscuits in Georgia, why do you never bring them?
I'll have to see what I can do about that.
Good grief. Okay, let's talk about Nintendo, shall we? This month, Nintendo released the newest edition of their very much-loved Pokemon series. It's called Pokemon Go. It's a smartphone app. It uses your GPS to help you search for Pokemon monsters while you're on foot. And after you catch a few of them, you can battle other trainers all around your town. More than 15 million people have downloaded. It is poised to possibly pass Twitter in downloads. But you know what? This is actually not the first time Nintendo has tried to get gamers to go outside. They've been trying for decades. Ever since the days of the first Game Boy, Nintendo has been pushing people, trying to, off their couches and into the world. And so let's begin with how many of you play Pokemon Go?
I have to admit that I do.
Kalina and Stefan. Yes. It's like half the table and then the other half just scowled at me.
Yeah.
My son's playing it. He's totally into it.
But no, not for you, Sam. How about your kids?
No. My youngest is kind of a Pokemon fan, and he's mentioned it a couple times, and I kind of give him the same look that I just gave you.
Nice. All right. But I wonder, how do we feel about Pokemon Go? I mean, some people are saying this is dangerous, but I kind of feel like, hey, Nintendo has finally figured out how to get people outside.
Yeah. My dog is exhausted. I have walked him so much. He's like, I was done going to the bathroom hours ago.
You know, interestingly enough, there's actually a shelter in one city that is inviting Pokemon Go players to, while they're searching, walk the shelter dogs.
That's genius.
Yeah. Right?
I saw that this morning.
That's great. Yeah.
I was interested in it only because so many people were just like, Pokemon Go, Pokemon Go. And I hate to feel like I'm left out of something cool. So that's I just started checking it out, and I said, oh, this could be fun. Because I was never actually into Pokemon.
But is it
itself.
Fun?
Sure, yes. Gets me outside. Why not?
What about all the people when the Holocaust Museum, for example, had to say, stop looking for Pokemon in the Holocaust Museum?
Yeah, there are certain places where they shouldn't be going into. I think they went into Arlington Cemetery to get Pokemon. But that said, I mean, Nintendo has gotten into something. I mean, they're managing to get all the nerds get a suntan, right?
Are you calling Kalina a nerd?
Well, they're not. But, you know, a lot of nerds are, you know.
All the nerds,
and nerd
except
is not
for
a bad
guys.
Thing. It's not a bad thing. Yeah. I'm a nerd.
Present company excluded. I hear you.
I feel obligated to say that I could see how it can be dangerous for some people. I believe one of the source articles for researching all of this, there was a gentleman talking about how, you know, speaking of all this Black Lives Matter and police brutality and things like that, certain areas that black men are just feeling like, oh, I don't know if I should be going into those neighborhoods.
Oh, I was thinking you were talking about differently. Like, people are already distracted by their cell phones and hurting themselves. I don't think Pokemon Go is going to make that worse.
That is also another thing.
Well, I don't know if that'll make it worse.
That have really real concerns. They're like, I'm already, you know, profiled for just being who I am. Right. What if I walk through a specific place looking for a Pokemon? And
that's a good point, but you don't even have to go that far. There are people, like, I know their goal is to get people walking, but there are people playing while they're driving. I was on 14th Street last night, and somebody dropped a lure, and there are cars pulling to the side of the road trying to steal people's Pokemon.
If you don't know what drop a lure is, then we're not going to explain it yet. Okay. Let's stay on the theme of games and talk about celebrity relationships. We all know there are some high-profile romances that are very short-lived. Like, should we all remember the infamous union of Kim Kardashian and Chris Humphries?
The choice to have your wedding on television, you are aware that that is going to get a big rating.
We don't do anything for ratings. Anyone that knows me knows that I love so hard. I fall in love fast. Mm-hmm. And I was in love.
Okay, that marriage lasted 72 days. One firm in China, though, has decided to take things a step further other than just talking about it. They, for a short time, allowed people to bet on the relationship of Taylor Swift and Tom Hiddleston, who started dating recently. That firm offered 2-to-1 odds that the couple would break up before the end of the year. It seems so mean. The site ended that practice after a week after they got an inquiry from the Chinese government. But what about that? And let me start with our lawyer here, because I wonder about the ethics of this.
Oh, yeah, because I'm definitely the person to ask. I would say it's totally unethical. And who would bet on a Taylor Swift relationship? Don't you have to have two people? You have someone betting against it and someone betting for it, and then, but I don't understand who would bet on it.
So like, you're saying she's a bad bet.
I'm just saying she's not trying. Like, would you bet on a horse in the Kentucky Derby that was like, meh, I'm not gonna run? That's what's happening here. Taylor Swift doesn't care.
But it's Tom Hiddleston, come on.
I don't even know who that is.
Well, the celebrity marriage thing, and it's not new. You look at Liz Taylor and Clark Gable had 12 marriages between them. I mean, that celebrity marriages are and I'm not a gambler. I don't gamble on anything really, but somebody really took advantage of a market force and could make some money in this if you could market it right. But like Stefan said, who's gonna bet on Taylor Swift not needing another bad guy song?
You will be
and
surprised.
Sending it to Tom Hiddleston.
You will be surprised by the amount of people that will probably place money on a relationship like that. I mean, we already bet on the ability of athletes to, play a sport well.
But they're trying. That's the whole thing with Taylor Swift.
That's not the point.
Have you watched some of our Atlanta teams?
It's just the Braves.
But we're just focusing on Taylor Swift. What about other celebrities, you see what I'm saying, who are actually trying to find
love? Well, let me put this question out to our listeners. If you would bet on Taylor Swift, it seems so mean. What if I were Taylor Swift? This would be mean. Let us know. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or just tweet us. How would you take that bet? Let's move on to a relatively more serious subject. Georgia's highest court recently ruled in favor of the Ku Klux Klan. Last Tuesday, the Georgia Supreme Court accepted the KKK's motion to adopt a 1-mile stretch of highway. That means in exchange for trash pickup, the KKK's name will appear on a highway sign in North Georgia. This is not the first time the KKK has adopted a highway. In fact, the Missouri ska band MU330 wrote a song about this in 2011.
Did you know that the KKK
So we only have a couple minutes, and we can return to this, because I imagine everybody has a lot to say. But let's just start here. Do you buy this denial, this argument that they, in order to respect their free speech rights, we had to allow them to adopt the highway?
Makes no sense at all. I mean, my problem is not with the KKK. My problem is ACLU. I mean, when they got to have a limit. I mean, they just can't
because
protect.
They defended the KKK's
right. Yes, exactly.
Right.
I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah, they didn't need to. I mean, the reality is it already won in other states and didn't need to do it here. I mean, the reason it won here in the final analysis is because the state of Georgia messed up the appeal, right? But it was probably going to win anyway. But, I mean, my position on this whole thing is, like, if you're going to walk, even for hate, you might as well pick up trash. People would be much more in favor of free speech if it came with a sort of cleanliness requirement. I'm just saying.
I just want to bang my head on the table right now.
Don't do that.
Okay,
that
I won't. I'm appalled by it, honestly. But,
Kalina is speechless for in her life. Sam, we got 30 seconds. Anything to say
this
here?
This is one that rips me between embarrassment and my love of free speech. And, I hate it.
Okay, it is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room, as we do on every Friday. My guests are Stefan Turkheimer, lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Hector Fernandez teaches world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. Kalina Balder is co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. And Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. And a special thanks, as always, to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that fuels our break room guests and me. Frankly, they're online at savannahcoffee.com, and the coffee is delicious. Okay, so look, Donald Trump is our presumptive Republican nominee, so we get a lot of news about him. Almost every public figure has weighed in on his controversial campaign. This week, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg gave her opinion on Trump. She called him, quote, a faker with a real big ego, end quote. Ginsburg has since apologized for that remark, but not before Trump replied to her by tweeting this, quote, Justice Ginsburg of the U.S. Supreme Court has embarrassed all by making very dumb political statements about me. Her mind is shot. Resign. End quote. Look, I don't honestly believe anyone thinks that Justice Ginsburg's mind is shot, right? I mean, that's fair.
By no means.
Okay, but what about a Supreme Court justice taking a political stance?
I mean, she shouldn't have done it, probably. But at the same time, she is an American with an opinion. And the Supreme Court has been specifically excluded from the judicial canons, which basically say you can't do all these various things. The Supreme Court's always been excluded from them. And the idea is these were always supposed to be semi-political justices. We've moved back from that, and there's an idea that they should be completely
neutral.
Yeah, and completely removed from the public eye. But that wasn't actually the original conception. That said, she probably shouldn't have taken a position like this, because the real problem is there's a theoretical chance that something that he does ends up in front of her. And so there would be a perception that she was biased against him. And that's the issue.
Okay. Mm.
That said, there is a double standard, because Escalia, may he rest in peace, was quite vocal about a number of things he thought, and he said them all the time.
He did make quite a few remarks about Obama.
And now Bader Ginsburg, she says something, and, you know, hell breaks loose. I mean, and so there is a double standard. Could it have to do a little bit with the fact that she's a woman? I don't know.
I think one of the threats that we're going to run into in this particular case is a very polarized electorate, a very heated election, a viable third candidate, throw in some voter irregularities like we had in 2000, and an election is sitting before our Supreme Court. And does Ruth Bader Ginsburg have to recuse herself from that? Or at that point you have, oh, well, she tipped it against Trump, or she had to back out and Trump won because of the alignment of the 8-person court.
Are you still hoping that Libertarian Gary Johnson is going to make a splash in this election?
With every ounce of my being.
Kalina?
RBG is everything. If I'm going to go straight millennial here.
We call her Notorious RBG.
Correct. Yeah. She is everything. And if you make it to drag queen costume rotation, you are it, okay? That's being said, while I agree with her opinions on Trump, I'm going to take the more conservative side on this. I really don't think she should have said that.
She did apologize.
She did apologize. I will give her that. And she said, look, I made this apology. I made this, you know, poor decision to say that. And I'm wondering who pushed her, because she said she was ill-informed.
Scalia never apologized, right?
That is correct.
There's still time. Oh, no.
All right. Since we're talking... Oh, man. All right. I disavow what Stefan Turkheimer just said. All right. Since we're talking about elderly people, let's talk about Napster. Remember Napster, LimeWire, music sharing? It's always been somewhat controversial. Many younger listeners justified file sharing as a so-called victimless crime, probably because the artists themselves, at least the headlining artists, were not hurting too bad financially.
Here you see the loving family of Master P. Next week is his son's birthday, and all he's ever wanted is an island in French Polynesia.
So he's gonna get it, right?
If things keep going the way they are, the child will not get his tropical paradise.
We're sorry. We'll never download music for free again.
So there's a recent internet survey that found older people are less likely to pay for their music than younger people. Why is this? Let me go with our youngest person in the room. Kalina.
I just think that, first of all, paying for music is way overrated. The elderly in this case really know what's up. I was a huge LimeWire Napster person in college, and I just said, you know, let's do it.
That's stealing, Kalina.
I know. It's, I know, and it's horrible, and I hear myself, and it's just crazy. But when you are, you know, when you're young, you're just like, okay, I need to save as much money as possible, but I got to know, you know, what the latest music is. I want to know what the latest trends are, da-da-da. I don't know if it's because older people maybe don't know the proper channels in which to pay for their music online. Are they
but
going...
they figure out how to steal it? Come on.
Well, they're not necessarily stealing it. We just know they're not buying it. I think what's happening is every say maybe 2 years or so, they check in. They're like, is Blink-182 still a thing? It is? Oh, I'm not interested. I think that's what's happening. And that seems totally reasonable.
I'm going to chalk it up to these, you know, just to look at older people used to buying things. They bought a CD. They bought a tape. They bought a record album. There was something that they were buying they could hold in their hands. It
they
was
don't
tangible.
See digital.
If you're buying a song that's on digital format, you're not thinking about, well, somebody had to do a lot of work to put this together.
Wait, so
this is somebody's
there's no evidence that they're stealing a ton of books, digital e-books.
There's are we looking into that, buying. Though?
I mean, but you're sitting there looking at something. You've got more than just your listening senses that you're putting into a digital book.
All right, well, let's put this out for our listeners. Do you pay for your music or do you steal it? What services actually are you willing to pay for if they're digital? And do you think it's why do are older people less likely to pay? You can tweet us now at OST Talk to join our break room. Okay, let's go back to politics just a little bit. The current political climate has caused a lot of people to lose faith in the government. I don't even know if that's current. I think it may have been a years-long trend. You'll remember earlier this year, Ammon Bundy led an armed insurrection in Oregon to retake a plot of government land. Last week, a group of sovereign citizens attempted to make a citizen arrest of four Clayton County commissioners here in Georgia. This is during one of the commissioners' meeting. That attempt was met with laughter among the people in the commissioners' room. But what's going on here? Is laughter the correct response, or do we think the sovereign citizen movement could grow?
I've never heard of a sovereign citizen until really when Obama took office. And I don't know if I missed this in school or, you know, public school system failing. But that being said, I've never heard of a sovereign citizen and what that entailed. So someone actually had to tell me what was going on when I heard about, you know, various people saying, oh, I'm putting you under this citizen's arrest, or I, you know, I'm a sovereign citizen, so you can't, you know, I'm claiming this land as my this. And I said, oh, this is, it's interesting. I don't know if it's necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, it's definitely a bad thing.
I don't know that much about it. And
she's saying she's ill-educated. Why is it bad?
Yeah. It's so basically these are people who think that they're not each among them are their own country. It's like they read very small parts of various documents and then develop an entire unified theory of self based on it. It's terrible. It's just really terrible. Hmm. And it's basically the leading edge of a movement that says the government can never get anything done. And that's really the problem with it. Also, these people don't buy music.
with this case, I'm going to side with Stefan on this a little bit, and I think this particular case is one that should have been dismissed with laughter.
You would have laughed, yeah.
I think there is a movement among a lot of people that began probably around 1775 of a distrust in government, and that's what our nation is built on. But at the same time, we can't devolve into anarchy. There has to be a rule of law. We have to have a standard that we all live by. And, I mean, whose authority are you going to arrest the commission over if you don't recognize the standing authority?
Well, right, you're asking the police,
right.
Part of the government.
Right. When you go in and you say, arrest yourself because you're violating my personal law. And you can't do that. There has to be an accepted standard that we all live by. But we also need to be constantly moving to change that standard.
Well, this used to be a French attitude. The problem is it's at least they believe they're going mainstream. I wish a lot of these people would actually get a passport and travel abroad so that they were able to have a comparative view.
Oh, for educational purposes.
Well, the problem is
educational purposes and see how our government, if you compare it to other governments in the world, actually our taxes are, you know, well used. I mean, there's corruption everywhere, sure. But, I mean, for the most part, we're getting a good deal. I mean, they should actually travel somewhere.
But who's going to issue that passport? Are they just going to write it in crayon?
That government, that government in which they don't believe.
Right.
It is Friday. We are in the break room. My guests are podcast host Kalina Baller, blogger Sam Burnham, Georgia State professor Hector Fernandez, and Georgia Poll editor Stefan Turkheimer. Okay. Even though Trump has said he mostly turns to himself when he needs advice, he does have a spiritual advisor, an official one. Her name is Paula White. She's an evangelical pastor based in Florida, but Georgia conservative Eric Erickson says he has noticed a theme in White's sermons. He says she talks about money so much that she is, quote, an actual heretic, end quote. Look, there are many followers of the prosperity gospel out there, and this is my question. If you focus a lot on money, does that automatically make you less spiritual?
Religion, money, what a hard connection. I mean, that's...
So cynical. Yeah. Okay. What do you think, Sam?
Again, in this particular case, big time, I mean, this is, if you talk money, okay, in the scripture, Jesus says you can't serve God and money.
Right. Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Right. And if money is the focus and you look at, oh, well, God wants you to be rich. Okay, well, go back and apologize to Jeremiah and the martyrs and all these other people who lived poor lives, but that were supposedly, as scripture teaches, very holy people. You can't take a prosperity message and apply it universally and expect it to be received with truth.
So is she a heretic?
Me, personally, not being an authority to determine her a heretic.
But for you.
But I see the teaching as heretical.
Okay. He agrees with Erickson on one thing.
I don't know that she's a heretic. I think what she's teaching might be heresy.
Okay.
I don't think what she's teaching is heresy. There were absolutely people who were, poor wealth-wise in the Bible, but there were also very wealthy people also in the Bible who we would also consider holy and or wise. So I just don't think that necessarily a prosperity gospel is heresy. It may be ridiculous when it gets to, you know what I mean? I mean, it may be ridiculous when it gets to, you know, certain levels, but I don't think it's heresy.
Right, but I think that all these, whenever you're talking about religion, you're talking about ministering to the unwashed, right? You try and meet those people where they are. So if you're going to pitch religion to Donald Trump, wouldn't it have to be lucre-based? Wouldn't it have to be money-based?
Right.
I mean, I don't think he's going to come to church unless you're going to have one of those cash drops at the end.
Absolutely.
That is a very interesting perspective.
And I'm not going to talk bad about, you know, rich people that are believers, because I think that you don't have to be poor to be a believer, to be spiritual, but...
Well, this looks sounds like something we need to put out to our listeners again, yeah, so definitely give us your thoughts.
What does the Bible say about rich people?
That it's harder for them to get to pass through a head of a needle, than to get into heaven. Okay, easier for them, excuse me. Anyhow, let's move on to something else that may be heresy. Sushi, not always healthy for you. No matter how many articles we read or how much advice we get, we never really know for sure, it seems, what's healthy to eat and what is junk food.
The best diet consists of food that occurs in the environment. It's natural food. Apples, berries, pears, watermelons.
Corn dogs.
Well, not really corn dogs, because that's not really a food. It's a food product.
Okay, you think most people would put corn dogs and, say, sushi pretty far apart on their spectrum of healthy eating, but it turns out nutritionists and those of us, we have very different ideas about what is good to eat, right? A New York Times survey revealed 90% of nutritionists rate quinoa as healthy. 40% of ordinary Americans were uncertain about quinoa. Granola bars were the most divisive food. 71% of us think they're healthy. Only 28% of nutritionists say they are healthy. So why don't we know at this point, with all that has been written, why don't we know what's good for us?
It literally says on the package of granola bars, healthy. On the outside.
And of course, advertising.
I'm just saying, what am I supposed to take from that? That it's not healthy? It doesn't make any sense. The only rule that I've found that ever works in terms of healthy versus not healthy is, do you actually want to eat it? If so, then it's not healthy. That's basically how it works.
Wait, what?
Nobody wants to eat quinoa. No. They're just eating it because they think it's healthy. No one's out there like, oh, I love quinoa.
Quinoa is not bad. The problem is how you cook it, because otherwise it's It's very hard
with
for
some kale and hemp hearts.
The problem with quinoa
and some corn dogs. You know where you need to cook that? In the trash.
You know what? Speaking of how you cook and how you prepare things, this idea of sushi being healthy or not healthy, I don't think a lot of Americans really know what true sushi is.
Sushi is fresh. So fresh. It's good that's for what you. I'm... And if you have it with brown rice, it's excellent.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think when a lot of people go out for sushi...
Right, but they're getting fried
That's what I'm saying. They're getting fried things.
Yeah.
They're getting cooked fish dipped in all kinds of sauces that are laden with sugar and salt. Yeah, so,
and,
you know.
It also doesn't help that, you know, you're driving down the road listening to radio and... A study reports that eggs will
you're
kill you.
It on
don't
radio.
Eat them. I'm not talking about the media itself. The reports that they're giving. This specialist says, you know, eggs will kill you if you eat one. And then the next study comes out that says, oh, you should eat lots of eggs because they're super healthy. So we get these conflicting reports, and you're like, okay, I'm going no carb because that's healthy. Well, they find out that'll kill you too. So then you do. Well, I'm gonna go. Low fat. Well,
that's
well,
the other thing,
you.
Though, which is that people confuse healthiness and weight loss, right? Because, I mean, like... You know,
we got 20 seconds here, Stefan. Keep it brief, counselor.
Totally.
We are out of time today in the break room, and I want to say thanks to all our guests. Stefan Turkheimer is a lawyer and editor for Georgia Poll. Hector Fernandez, professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. Kalina Baller, co-host of the Real Snobs podcast. And Sam Burnham curates the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. So that is our show for today, but let's put the question out to you. Do you feel like the things you think are healthy are actually healthy? And what's the healthiest thing you could eat? Or does it taste bad? Call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. For today and the week, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.